I'm your host, Nick Jacomas, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Claire Bryant. Dr. Bryant is a professor of innate immunity at the Cambridge Immunology Network at Cambridge University in the UK, and she studies the innate immune system, how bacteria are detected by the immune system using pattern recognition receptors. She studies how allergen proteins are detected, how toxic proteins are produced in patients that have things like chronic inflammatory diseases, allergies, Alzheimer's disease. She's looking at the immune system, the component of the immune system that acts right away, called the innate immune system. So we talked about what that means and how it's different from the adaptive immune system, the part of the immune system that stores memories and creates antibodies tuned to specific infections that we get. We talked about inflammation and the mechanisms of inflammation in the body, how bacteria and other pathogens are detected by the immune system, how the innate immune system triggers inflammation to deal with the infection, to recruit the adaptive immune system and help keep us free of debris from damage. We talked about things like allergies, food allergies, and other types of allergies, where they come from, why they arise. We talked about chronic inflammation, why inflammation can become chronic, you know, how it lasts too long and can cause damage throughout life. We talked about the connection between inflammation and aging. We talked about the evolution of the immune system, which components of the immune system that are relatively old versus relatively new in evolutionary terms, a little bit about how immune systems differ between different types of animals, like carnivores versus scavengers, you know, bats versus humans and so forth. And so if you're interested in the immune system, how inflammation works, the mechanisms behind inflammation, if you're interested in how allergies develop and how the immune system can go awry and act inappropriately, this is a really interesting episode for you. Claire is an expert on inflammation and the innate immune system. As always, remember that I have a Remember to visit mindandmatter.substack.com. You'll find my long-form science writing there together with the podcast material I have in audio and video format. You'll find show notes there. You can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter with podcast updates, links to interesting research and other resources. And if you want to support the podcast further, you can become a paid subscriber. That helps me keep going and keep growing. This episode is supported in part by Athletic Greens. Their main product, AG1, is a comprehensive and convenient daily nutrition product containing 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients with less than 1 gram of sugar per serving, no nasty chemicals or artificial anything. It's gluten and dairy free and compatible with paleo, vegan, vegetarian, and ketogenic diets. AG1 is a quick and convenient way to supplement your diet to help ensure your body is getting the nutrients it needs. It comes in powder form and you can mix it in water and drink it, or you can put it into a smoothie or a shake or something like that. I mix it into water and drink it with the first meal of each day, and it's super convenient. If you go to athleticgreens.com/mindandmatter, Athletic Greens will give you a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. Their vitamin D product comes in tincture form, so you just take one drop each day. A large fraction of the population is actually vitamin D deficient, especially in winter months when we get less sun exposure, and vitamin D is super important for the proper function of the immune system and for a variety of other things. And there's even evidence indicating that vitamin D deficiency is correlated with more severe cases of COVID-19 in those who get infected. Every time I go into the doctor each year for a checkup, I'm always told that vitamin D deficiency is very common and I should be supplementing on a daily basis. So visit athleticgreens.com/mindandmatter or click the link in the episode description. You'll get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D with your first purchase. And with that, here's my conversation with Dr. Claire Bryant. Can you start off by just telling everyone a little bit about who you are, what your scientific background is, and what your lab studies?
Yeah, sure. So I am Professor of Innate Immunity at the University of Cambridge in the United Kingdom. So what that really means is that I am really interested in studying the frontline mechanisms that fight pathogen infections, so predominantly bacterial, actually, in my case. And in particular, I'm really interested in understanding zoonotic infections. So after COVID, I don't really have to explain what a zoonotic infection is anymore. I will do, but I used to have to make a big song and dance about this. But basically, infections that are tolerated by animals, but that jump into people. Sometimes these infections cause disease in animals, but more often than not, they don't. And I'm really interested in understanding the immune mechanisms that allow these infections to be tolerated by the animals, yet when they come into people, they cause inflammatory and infectious disease. And actually, from this, I've been led on to work on a number of sterile infectious diseases. That includes Alzheimer's disease, obesity, and a variety of other problems, which has been kind of an interesting migration for somebody, because actually I was trained as a veterinarian, and I find myself working on a host of diseases that affect humans as well as animals.
Okay, so you were actually trained as a veterinarian.
Yeah, that's correct.
So you went to vet school, but then yep. You're basically doing basic research. How did that happen? I think that's pretty unusual.
Yeah, it is unusual. So it was an interesting career track, really, because it wasn't really what I anticipated doing. Although I did a primary basic training in physiology and biochemistry and did some research then and really got excited by the concept of research. I did a summer vacation job, in fact, which really was like a light bulb moment where I thought, oh, research, this is really interesting. But I went on to do my veterinary degree and complete the training. And what I appreciated very early on was that whilst I found animal disease fascinating and the patients are really cool, sometimes the owners are a little bit more difficult, which is why I trained to be a vet and not a medic. But what was very frustrating for me was that in the clinic, I couldn't really get to a molecular answer. And I realized I really did need to understand a really fundamental, basic, mechanistic answer. And I was not going to get there in clinical practice. And so that really decided my career for me, because from that point on, I thought, all right, I need to understand mechanisms. And that requires me really digging into the research to understand what's going on. And so from that point on, my career track was sort of defined and determined to be really basic biomedical research.
And so professor of adaptive immunity. Innate. Yeah. I'm tripping over my own question here.
It's very important.
Yes. In fact, I think it would be good if you explained for people what's the difference between innate and adaptive immunity.
Yeah, for sure. So innate immunity is the first line of defense. So what happens is when a pathogen enters the body, it will encounter initially a set of barriers. So it's things like your mucosal barrier in your lungs or your gut. It will then encounter a set of sort of primary immune cells, for example, neutrophils and macrophages. And the job of those cells is to see the pathogen and try and kill it. And the specificity there comes from receptors or proteins in the cell membrane that allow you to detect pathogens and discriminate that as being different from the host. And what these cells also do is send out signals to recruit adaptive immune cells. So this is things like T cells and B cells, which provide the memory and repeat response when a pathogen comes along again. These cells are recruited. They talk to things like the macrophages and a special set of cells called dendritic cells. And this interaction then between naive T or B cells, T cells, right, between naive T cells and the dendritic cells in a whole milieu of pro-inflammatory proteins. So inflammation is a very important part of this process. Then drives the differentiation of the T cells, which then go on to form B cells, T cells. They drive memory, all the basis of a response that's long-term, whereas the innate response is very immediate and critically important for instructing the adaptive immune response. So it's a kind of two-phase response, but the innate response is your first line of defense against pathogens.
Mm-hmm. So as the names of these things imply, the adaptive immune response would be, it's things that are not specifically baked in. They have to be learned through trial and error. That's where we think about things like antibodies for specific infections. And the innate immune response is it's baked in. It's ready to go, from the beginning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's really important. And of course, the critical thing about the adaptive immune response is the memory. And there's some component of a genetic modification that ties into innate immunity, but it's nothing really like the profound memory immune responses that we see in T and B cells.
Mm-hmm. And So the innate immune response, let's say you have a bacteria infection, some bug has gotten into the body. Somehow the innate immune system is detecting that. You mentioned that there are receptors that are recognized or proteins that are recognized on the bacteria. Can you talk a little bit about how that works? What kinds of receptors are recognized and what does that process actually look like?
So what actually happens is there are receptors in the cell membrane that recognize molecules in the pathogens. So if you're talking about a bacteria, the bacteria has a host of specialized coatings on its surface, one of which is called lipopolysaccharide. So that's a lipid. It also has bacterial proteins in its surface. It can have flagella, which are tails, which cause the bacteria to swim. Either the proteins or the lipids are then recognized by receptors in the innate immune cells. And so one of those, for example, lipopolysaccharide, is a massively toxic molecule. And there's a receptor called toll-like receptor 4, which is a part of a family of receptors called pattern recognition receptors. And their job is exactly what it sounds like. They recognize molecular patterns from non-self molecules. Okay, usually from non-self molecules. So they'll recognize, for example, bacterial lipopolysaccharide. And the interaction of the toll-like receptor or the pattern recognition receptor with the bacterial molecule then triggers a signaling cascade, which ultimately results in the production of an inflammatory response. And it's a very powerful inflammatory response. And the whole point of that response is twofold. One is to kill the pathogen, and two is to instruct the adaptive immune response to say, hey, this pathogen is here. You need to come help me kill it. And so that's kind of the cascade that's involved when a bacterium arrives. And there's a whole family of pattern recognition receptors. We understand a lot about them now. They're really interesting. Some of them recognize nucleic acids, some of them recognize lipids, some of them recognize proteins, some of them recognize carbohydrates. But all of these things are actual key features to instructing the innate immune system to tell the body that a pathogen has arrived.
Yeah, so it strikes me here that there could be actually an analogy between the innate immune response and basic sensory detection and sensory perception. So I have a neuroscience background. So, when you think about vision or olfaction or the sensation of things in the physical environment outside the body, right? In the visual system, you've got a retina. There are specialized receptors on the neurons in the retina that detect, in this case, photons of light. They detect certain photons of light. They respond in certain ways. Those signals downstream are then combined in ways that lead to visual perception. This seems like an analogous situation. The stimulus is something from the outside world that actually gets into the body, but there are, it sounds like, specialized receptors that are detecting some feature that is found only or mostly on other types of creatures, but not in ourselves. How far can we take that analogy?
Yeah, it's pretty similar actually, and I would say one of the things was that pattern recognition receptors were discovered relatively recently. Young people would not say it's relatively recently, but it is relatively recently in the late 1990s, and it was something that we knew there had to be a system out there to see these patterns, but we didn't know where it was. And indeed, it is informed by all the other receptors that we know exist for a wide variety of physiological processes. So it became increasingly obvious there had to be something similar for pathogens, and it was a really phenomenal advance for which the Nobel Prize actually was awarded, to actually find what is the receptor that sees a bug. There's got to be one there. And when they were found, everybody, we were all very excited because it gave us a mechanism to suddenly go, okay, now we can work out what's going on. We can work out how to stimulate this to improve our vaccines. We can work out how to inhibit it to prevent inflammation and so forth. So the analogy is very real. I think the only addition I would add to that is that these receptors now not only recognize pathogens but can also recognize host damage molecules, in other words, things that would normally be produced in disease or things that are in the wrong place. So normally bits and pieces of this of the cell machinery exist in a certain compartment in the nucleus, for example, for nucleic acids, or in different vacuoles in the cell. If things get out of the wrong place or things get out of the cell, which we call damage-associated molecular patterns, some of them can be picked up by these pattern recognition receptors. And we think this is part of the way in which a number of chronic inflammatory diseases occur. Just by detecting these things in the wrong place, and these receptors then do their job, which is to generate inflammation. But of course, that can be damaging to the body.
So it sounds like this is a system for detecting biological components that are out of place, not necessarily distinct organisms.
I mean, it's predominantly distinct organisms. But imagine, for example, as a neuroscience context, we know that these receptors can recognize amyloid beta, which is associated with Alzheimer's, or can recognize alpha-synuclein associated with Parkinson's. And it's a particular size of these proteins and a oligomer that we know that they're associated with pathogenesis. And that we think that these proteins are detected by these receptors. They drive inflammation, and this helps to explain why there's a neuroinflammatory component to these really nasty brain diseases.
And so with innate immunity, how specific can the recognition capabilities of this phase of the immune response get? Is it simply able to detect that a bacteria has entered the body, or is there specificity? Is there more specificity than that? Can it detect and distinguish between certain species of bacteria versus fungi, et cetera, and then relay that for the adaptive immune response? Or is it just sort of like something foreign is in here?
No, there's really quite a lot of sophistication in there, and this is an ongoing area of research actually, because the link between innate and adaptive immunity and how do you tell it a specific bug there, I think is remains a part what I would call a partially resolved question. But for example, toll-like receptor 4, which is one of my favorite pattern recognition receptors, recognizes bacterial lipopolysaccharide, which is a lipid in the outer coating of a bacterium. This lipid. Each bacterium makes its own lipopolysaccharide. And depending upon the structure of that lipid, it can be seen very differently by toll-like receptor 4. So some lipids are massively proactive and they cause a lot of inflammation. But sometimes the bugs are clever, and sometimes a bug can, for example, decrease the number of what we call acyl chains, which are the fatty chains in the bacterial lipopolysaccharide, such that it's no longer seen, or it's seen as what we call an antagonist or an inhibitor by the TLR4. And a real key example of that is Yersinia pestis, the plague bug. Everybody loves the plague bug. It has the capability to switch this lipopolysaccharide, so it can switch between an inflammatory and an anti-inflammatory species when it's in the body. And that's part of the way why how it manages to evade detection by the body. So we have this kind of arms race where the pathogen tries to evade the innate immune system in order to be able to do what it wants to do. Meanwhile, the body is trying to adapt to this, but obviously the pathogen can evolve much faster than the immune system in dealing with these kind of issues.
Well, so it really is like a form of camouflage, or I'm almost imagining someone in the special forces blending into the culture they're actually infiltrating.
Exactly that. It's very interesting. The biology we learn from what we understand by the immune system, but also what bacteria or viruses or fungi do to hide from the immune system becomes very important, particularly if you're thinking about therapeutics, because these are potential mechanisms that we can leverage to modify the immune system and its responses.
So these lipopolysaccharides, these are components of bacteria. They vary from species to species, so they can be used as a kind of fingerprint to get more specificity there. But are they also just a general purpose discrimination tool? Are these things that are never found on our own cells, or do we have similar structures in our own cells?
So that's an interesting question, and I tell you why, because it for a long time we were trying to understand whether or not these were specifically just for a bacterium, or did they have other functions. And there is some nice evidence to suggest that certain lipids in the body can also be seen by some of these receptors. And that's an emerging field, and we've certainly thought about this in the context of some of the intracellular as well as cell membrane receptors. And we thought about this in the context of intracellular receptors, and certainly some work's been done on toll-like receptor 4, and things like ceramide and cholesterol species can trigger to a degree some activation of toll-like receptor 4. This is very much it's an emerging field, because sometimes these molecules are quite difficult to manage and use and work with in our experimental systems. From a bacterial point of view, though, it's been very clear, and it is not very well worked out, but we understand more and more all the time, and we know a lot about bacterial endotoxins because they've been so important in infection biology for a long time. But the host arm of the research is sort of emerging more and more now, I think. And as we become more sophisticated at understanding metabolism and the metabolic products that are produced in the body, we become more able to explore this biology.
And so all animals, as far as I'm aware, have an immune system of some kind. I imagine there's both a lot of conservation at one level and a lot of diversity at another level. When it comes to the innate immune response and things like the initial detection of pathogens through these pattern recognition receptors, how old in evolutionary terms is this system? Is this something conserved across the animal kingdom? Or how can we think about how and when this part of the immune system evolved?
So it's been around a long time. So, for example, the sea urchin, so that's way back in the day, and way early in the evolutionary tree, has, if I remember rightly, it's something like 271 toll-like receptors, which are pattern recognition receptors. And so what we see as animals developed an adaptive immune system, the need to have so many toll-like receptors reduced, or so many pattern recognition receptors was reduced, because you're gaining a sophistication and a way of fighting infections that doesn't wholly rely on the innate immune system. And I think that's why you see the kind of shrinkage from the animal, the very early stages of animal immunity. So I think, as I say, sea urchins, who are early in the evolutionary tree. What becomes then very interesting is when you start to look at different animals. Is there really are some very interesting differences in the innate immune receptors across our species. So if we think about birds, which are really just flying dinosaurs, obviously, and they're super interesting. Okay, they have a quite a condensed immune system. As you go down the tree, if you look at humans, they've got quite an expanded, humans and mice, for example, have an expanded innate immune tree. So that means they have quite a lot of pattern recognition receptors. Nothing like the sea urchin. Okay, nothing like the sea urchin, but we're talking 10, 12. And then what then is interesting is looking at other animals. And this is research that's been coming through as we speak, really, because as the sophistication of genomics in species other than humans and mice becomes more and more and more worked on, and we now have a fantastic resource, but it's improving all the time. People are sequencing genomes all the time. You begin to be able to study the innate immune tree, and that's the only bit I've looked at, of course, because I love the innate immune system, and I'm particularly pattern recognition receptors, so I'm very focused on what I look at. But for example, the carnivora, so we're talking dogs, cats, these species have actually started to lose some of these receptors, which is very interesting. And they've lost some of the receptors, and they've lost what I call the effector protein. So you have the receptor that detects the pathogen, and then you have an effector system which initiates the inflammatory response. So dogs and cats, for example, have lost. You can see that some of the pattern recognition receptors have become pseudogenes, and that's the first step in these receptors being lost. And presumably that's because their immune system is evolving. They're carnivores, they have a high protein diet, they have lots of antimicrobial peptides. And we think that perhaps this diet and so forth actually means that some of the innate immune systems that are present, for example, in the gut, may not be necessary, because the mucosal barrier is very well populated and learns to deal with these things. And you'd need to do that if you're a dog, because dogs eat terrible things. Cats are very sophisticated and very picky, but dogs, they're really not, right?
And
But then,
I think what you're saying is right, the lifestyle of the animal in terms of its diet and other things, but in the context of pathogens, it's the pattern with which it encounters pathogens in the world is going to dictate the type of immune system it needs. Some might need something like a sea urchin need to hard code the identity of a bunch of pathogens early on. Others have this adaptive response, so they can learn through experience to fine tune their immune response, and you don't need to encode all that information in the genome up front. But you said something that was kind of interesting to me, which is you said there was this reduction in sort of the innate immune system repertoire as you go from earlier animals to later animals. Presumably that reflects a greater need over time to respond to a greater diversity of pathogens. And there's this sort of information encoding problem where you simply can't hard code all of them in the genome. But at the same time, you said in different lineages, like the human and the mouse lineage, there was this sort of expansion of some kind.
Yeah.
Does that have to do with things like diet, where, you know, if a mouse or a human is the type of creature that is a opportunistic omnivore that's going to be scavenging lots of questionable food items, they might need to have, they might need to amp up certain arms of the immune system compared to other animals?
I mean, that's my best guess. Okay, I would love to be able to prove this because it's extraordinarily interesting. And so, yes, I think that is part of the deal. I think perhaps the elephant in the room we haven't discussed is the bat, of course, and the bat has also lost a number of genes. But, you know, the argument is bats fly and they have a high metabolic rate, and that may mean that they lose some of these immune genes because they can't afford to still have them there. I don't know whether that's true or not, but it's certainly an interesting hypothesis. And I think lifestyle, the way in which animals live, what they eat and how they thrive is central to the reasons why there's such diversity in the innate immune system, which is kind of interesting because this means then that these animals have the capability to tolerate some pathogens and just not be seen. Mm-hmm. Which really underpins the zoonotic problem, right? People come into contact with animals in the wrong place. With the human, for example, has an immune system which will see the pathogen, whereas the bat or the bird, for example, will house the pathogen and doesn't really care it's there. Mm-hmm. And it's a series of events: the pathogen evolving, the human being in the wrong place, all these kind of ecological immune and pathogen factors create the perfect storm, which is what happened with COVID. COVID, we think, came from bats, we think, and it's still controversial.
Yep. Are you talking about SARS-1 or SARS-2?
SARS-2. We know, for example, that SARS-CoV-2 during the pandemic actually went into mink, came back out again and mutated en route. And we've just got through talking about differences in the innate immune system in the mink. Again, this is a possible way in which these kinds of events and mutation events occur. It's a series of really interesting questions that, I think from an immune point of view are super important for us to understand moving forward to be prepared to deal with emerging pathogens and pandemics in the future.
Another little thing that you said there that was interesting, I think, is you mentioned that certain carnivores have lost certain components of the immune system. And you said, I think, that they produce, you basically said they produce antimicrobial molecules in their gut. So the question I have related to that is, so we've got this innate immune system. It's capable of detecting with some amount of specificity, different types of bacteria and other pathogens. So it's this sort of almost sensory detection system. It's got some level of specificity. Are there also just sort of very general purpose antimicrobe mechanisms at play, just molecules that get released that just sort of do not discriminate? And what are some of those?
Yeah, so I mean, this is not my area of expertise, but antimicrobial peptides are a really nice example of this. So in your gut, you produce a whole layer of non-specific mechanisms in the gut. You produce mucus, for example, which helps to provide a barrier to sort of prevent bacteria crossing the tract. You produce, your gut moves, right? And the movement also stops the bugs getting a handle on it. We produce antimicrobial peptides, which help to coat the bacterium and help to destroy it, basically. So there are a bunch of sort of non-specific mechanisms, which are really... all your front line of defense before you actually get to things like the macrophages with a sort of a level of specificity, the innate immune cells rather, with a level of specificity. So there's a whole bunch of really important factors that help to prevent you getting infected. Otherwise, to be frank, if you think about it, we have a microbiome, in other words, a microbial population in the lungs and in our guts. And if we didn't have these kind of barriers, we'd just be ill all the time.
Okay, so this will maybe be a little bit of a vague question. I'll let you sort of drive the level of specificity. But on a high level, let's assume we're talking about a human being and we're talking about a bacterial infection of some kind. Maybe we'll just think of some common bacterial infection. The bacteria gets in. It somehow gets in and the innate immune response happens, and then everything downstream of that happens. What are some of the key steps from detection of the pathogen initially to resolution of infection? What are some of the key steps that are happening there along the way?
Yeah, so you have the pathogen. It's seen by a receptor at the cell. Step number one, okay? The innate immune cell will do things like try and engulf that pathogen. It doesn't always succeed, but it will try, but say it does. Okay, it will then try and kill that pathogen. So if it, one of the things it's able to do then is take bits of that pathogen, and that's, they call this antigen, okay? And it's able to then take that out and put it on the cell surface. And while it's responding to the pathogen, it's also produced a bunch of signals which are recruiting naive T cells. So these are T cells that don't have any fixed role, right? And so the T cells are recruited, and T cells have receptors that recognize antigen. And so the antigen on the innate immune cell, particularly dendritic cells, will be presented to a T cell. And the T cell is always has this phenomenally complex series of receptors, and it's so sophisticated. It's beyond my mental capacity to really understand how this works, mm-hmm. because it's so sophisticated. But somehow it has the capacity to be able to recognize any antigen effectively. Hmm. And so you've got your bug antigen, you've got your T cell, which has found its a little bit of peptide which it recognizes. This then causes multiplication of the T cells that then go off, and this all happens in the lymph node. They then go off and they make B cells, which produce antibodies. They make other T cells, so killer T cells, for example, that can come along and take out the pathogen, cytotoxic T cells. So that there are a whole bunch then of responses downstream. So these then come in and further promote, amongst other things, the innate immune cells to then keep on killing the pathogen.
So if I'm following, it's basically like the pathogen gets in, the macrophage has these tool-like receptors that can recognize certain components of the bacteria. If we liken that to a security guard, the security guard identifies the invader, captures the invader, takes off a little identifying piece of the invader, and then shows other security guards what the invader looks like and what to look out for. And then at the same time is also just sort of like blowing a whistle or something. There's a non-specific signal that just says, hey, I need help over here. And through both of those pathways, you get a bunch of other security guards that come in. Some of them are very specific at identifying specific things, and some of them are probably just general purpose muscle to get rid of the problem.
Yeah, that's exactly. That's more or less it in a nutshell. And this is the whole basis of the links then between innate and adaptive immunity. And then what happens is, of course, your adaptive immune cells go off. They send in further security guards to further on the analogy, which helps to combat the rest of the infection. But also it seeds a memory cell. Okay, so a security guard goes off and sits in his nice warm cell, waiting for the call next time. And the next time he comes, that security guard brings a whole army so that it shuts down an infection very quickly.
I see. Yeah. So after this happens once, you know, you've got a photograph of the perpetrator, you've fingerprinted him, and so you're then on guard looking for that particular pathogen in the future. So the response is just quicker and more effective.
And that exactly right. And that's the whole point behind vaccination.
You're preempting that memory component.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, this is why the COVID vaccination policies were so important, because once you're vaccinated, COVID arrives and in come the security guards to can it as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, so on that theme, on the one hand, you know, human beings have figured out how these mechanisms work. And so we can invent things like vaccines that induce this adaptive immune response before or in place of getting a full-blown genuine infection. On the other hand, sometimes people get vaccinated and then they get infected with a virus anyway. And this gets back to this idea of this arms race that happens, I suppose. So I guess things like viruses and bacteria, they themselves are constantly evolving new abilities to get around this adaptive immune response.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, COVID is a great example of this, actually. So, what happened with COVID was we made vaccines against the spike protein, okay, which was a very specific part of COVID. And this then particularly drove two things. It drove antibody production. But what happens is the antibodies then recognize that spike protein from that particular strain of the virus. Okay. It also drove the production of killer T cells. So they they recognize COVID as well, but they seem to be a little bit more broad spectrum. The antibody is very, very specific with what it recognizes. And then what happened is, as you know, COVID was extremely efficient at mutating. It was the spike protein in particular that mutated. And if you get, because an antibody is so specific in what it recognizes amino acids in the spike protein. And what COVID did was it mutated lots of those amino acids in the spike protein. And at a certain point, so many changes in those amino acids in the spike protein occurred that the antibody could no longer very efficiently bind onto that spike protein. And so the vaccines became less effective. And so hence the reason to update the vaccines all the time, because you then can fine tune it towards the spike protein of the mutating virus. It's probably the best example, certainly at the moment, of how the virus evolves and how we need to be responding to prevent that. And we're very lucky, because with the new RNA vaccines, you can do exactly that. It's fairly quick to change the RNA sequence in an RNA vaccine, which is exactly for the spike protein. So you can just change some of the sequences in that RNA vaccine, which then means you make a very, very specific new vaccine against the new strain, and it's a constantly evolving system.
I see. This actually brings me to another question I had, which is, when COVID was first happening, I got the initial two doses of one of the mRNA vaccines, and I became very symptomatic in response to the vaccine. I then subsequently, after getting vaccinated, got infected with COVID, and there was a somewhat similar but distinct set of symptoms that I got. And so symptoms coming from the immune response on its own without infection, symptoms coming from either the infection per se or my immune response to an actual infection. When we get sick, when we have a bacterial viral infection, we have a runny nose or we're vomiting or whatever it is, do those symptoms come primarily from the immune system's response to the bug, or do they come from, say, toxins being released by the pathogen, or is it a mix of the two?
It's a mix of the two. Okay. So ultimately, the immune system has a very specific set of responses. So one of the things the body does is produces not only messenger proteins, but inflammatory proteins. Okay. And these inflammatory proteins, inflammatory mediators, do a whole host of things. For example, they drive a fever response. So as you'll know, if you have a viral infection, you get a fever. The host inflammatory response, driving an increase in body temperature. And the reason for that is because if you've got a high body temperature, you're providing a hostile environment for the pathogens to proliferate. And so it helps to slow the proliferation of the pathogens. And so there's a whole bunch of responses that occur like that to try and wall off, kill, control pathogen. But the consequences of that is, you can feel sick due to the immune response to the pathogen. But some pathogens can produce toxins in their own right. So the cholera, for example, a part of the pathogenesis is due to a toxin, which then triggers diarrhea, and which is due to causing problems in your gut epithelial, your gut barrier. And that's toxin driven, but you're almost at the point of saying it's a toxin that then changes the host cell, and the host cell then responds in this way. So it's a moot point as to is it an immune response or is it pathogen toxin? Pathogen toxins will trigger a change in the body, which will then trigger a response. So it's how your body responds to the pathogen that's absolutely key. And that can be toxin driven, or that can be driven by the pathogen, or both.
I see. So ultimately, it's the response of the immune system to the body that's generating the symptoms. In some cases, the detection of the pathogen, you're detecting an otherwise benign component of the pathogen that isn't actually directly harming you like a weapon. In other cases, they do produce toxins that are part of their pathogenesis. But ultimately, it's how we're responding that's generating most of the symptoms, it sounds like.
Yeah, indeed.
So inflammation is important. Let's actually just talk about what inflammation is to make sure we've got background for my next question. So I think everyone has at least an intuitive sense for what inflammation is. Our tissues often get literally inflamed. They get bigger when we get a bruise or when we have an infection or something. That presumably involves the recruitment of all of these cells, all of these immune cells coming into a region where they're needed. But how would you define inflammation? What are the key characteristics that define it? And is there anything here worth mentioning that maybe people don't normally think about?
So yeah, so the inflammation has been known about for a long time. It was defined by the Greeks, if I remember correctly. And there are a bunch of very clear responses that happen. So you get redness. So what happens is if you get damage to, your hand, so your skin, you'll see a redness, and that's an increased blood flow. So, and the blood is flowing into the site of a damage or site of an infection intrinsically, actually, to try and get rid of the infection and dilute it away. So you get redness. You get an increase in body temperature, as I've said. So that increase in body temperature is to provide a hostile environment. You get swelling, and that's often due to an influx of tissue fluid that then again dilutes out the environment where the tissue is. There's one other thing, and it's going to elude me now. Now I'm on the spot. Redness,
swelling, temperature change.
Pain.
Sensitization. Okay.
Sensitization, and that the point of the pain is to make sure you don't make further damage that area that's there, right? So you have all these signs happening at the same time.
I see. So when you get a bruise or a broken bone, the pain that you feel is not simply a side effect of something that's broken. It's actually a feature of the body's response to prevent you from messing with the tissue further.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't want to be walking on a broken bone, right? If you imagine the primordial response, you're trying to protect that area of your body and not make it any worse. So these are the kind of signs associated with inflammation, and it's great as a protective mechanism, but when it gets out of control, okay, then it starts to be a problem, and that's the challenge with a whole bunch of other diseases. In infection, its job is to try and control the pathogen and get rid of it.
Yes, I definitely want to go there in a few moments. The control of inflammation in space and time. Before we get there, I want to understand a couple other things. So you mentioned there's this temperature change. There's an increase in temperature, and it sounds like that's also a feature to mess with the ability of pathogens to replicate, rather than being the passive consequence of more metabolic activity. Is that accurate?
Yeah, no, that's definitely the case. I mean, part of inflammation is a metabolic change. Metabolic change contributes to the increase in body temperature, but actually the factor that drives the body temperature increase is twofold. So it's a protein, which is a pro-inflammatory cytokine called interleukin-1 beta. That triggers the production of some lipids, prostaglandins, in fact, prostaglandin E2, which is a very specific prostaglandin. Okay, and so, that can go into the brain.
So those are the things that NSAIDs inhibit, prostaglandins.
That's exactly right. Yes, that's exactly right. So that is because prostaglandins trigger thermoreceptors, and that triggers an increase in temperature. So yeah, so if you take NSAID, a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, for example, aspirin, that's one of the things it does is it by blocking the prostaglandins, it will help decrease your body temperature.
Interesting. So you've got this increase in temperature, which is a feature. You've got redness, which comes from vasodilation. That makes perfect sense. You need more stuff going there. So the blood flow is going to carry a lot of the fuel for that. I want to talk a little bit about metabolism here and how expensive this whole process is. I imagine it's pretty energetically expensive. You have to recruit all of these different cells. You have to induce cell differentiation. They're doing sophisticated things like engulfing bacteria and sending off different signals. I'll let you dictate how we talk about this. I don't know what the best way to do it for general audiences. Like how expensive measured in ATP, say, is the immune response?
Oh, see, that's a question I'm really not best placed to answer, to be honest. You're dead right. It is very expensive. It is energetically hugely expensive. And you can see, for example, this is definitely not an area I'm an expert in, but for example, the macrophages in an innate immune cell, you can see real shifts in the use of various metabolites in the cell, energy metabolites. So when a cell becomes inflamed, the whole of its metabolism is shifted. And that shift is to drive an inflammatory response. And at a very simple stage, you can look at a cell in a dish, a Petri dish, and you can see the medium changes color because and the inflamed macrophages produces acid type products. And so the medium then goes from pink to yellow. So the whole field, there's a massive field of immunometabolism, which is thinking exactly about this, the adaptive immune system. Does it, the innate immune system does it. This huge fuel to try and fight infection. It's a phenomenally energetically important process. And if you've got a fever, you tend not to eat, which is kind of an interesting because you don't feel like it, right?
I was actually just thinking this. Yeah, like you often lose your appetite, but given what we're talking about, you might think the opposite would be the case. Like you want to fuel this process, which is very expensive. So, yeah, how do we even start to think about that?
It's an interesting question. It partly depends upon, I think, the pathogen. And there's kind of an old-fashioned saying which I vaguely remember from when I was a child. It's like starve a fever and feed a cold, or the other way around, and I can't remember which one it is. And I think there's elements to that. You might imagine that if you've got a chronic, and this is true, if you've got a chronic inflammation, okay, or a chronic infection, you tend to lose weight and because your things like your muscle breaks down and it's being used to feed this inflammatory process. And so you can imagine that if you can take on food to combat that, it's going to help. But it is fiendishly complex. Inflammation is very energetically hungry.
Yeah, just, I mean, just speaking off the cuff a little bit, we talked about evolution earlier. Different animals have different lifestyles, and their immune systems are going to evolve in concert with their lifestyle, including their diet. When I think about, what I know about evolutionary anthropology in humans show a lot of features in terms of our digestive and metabolic physiology. And, based on what we know from fossils and other things as well, that, we're obviously highly omnivorous, and we've probably done a lot of scavenging of dead food killed by other things in our past. And I wonder if there's something to that that ties in here. So, for example, if at least certain types of infections often come from ingesting a pathogen, you might want to make the animal stop eating so it doesn't eat more of the cause.
I mean, I think that's interesting, right? And I think humans have so humans and dogs are a really good comparator, right? I said dogs eat horrible things. They do. They seem to be indiscriminate in what they eat, and their innate immune system is different to a human's, which is more sophisticated. And I wonder how much things like smell and various aversion tactics come into play here, but also things like carnivores are pathogens. What am I talking about? Carnivores are predator animals, and the difference between a predator, prey, and an omnivore. I think that whole balance and the ecology that's associated with that is super interesting in infection susceptibility. But one thing I did read relatively recently is, they found it. So there's been a lot of sequencing of ancient DNA and the Neanderthal DNA, and there seems to be some conservation with of some Neanderthal DNA in some of our pattern recognition receptors. And the suggestion being then that over evolution, as infection has placed a pressure on our immune system, we've kind of selected to certainly acquire from our Neanderthal relatives some of their genetic sequences and some of the pattern recognition receptors, presumably to make us more efficient at fighting infection. So I think there's a whole interesting evolutionary investigation there.
Interesting. So I want to ask one more question related to the inflammatory process itself. There's this term that I'm familiar with, but I really know very little about this, and I know that it's something that you've studied in particular. There's something called the inflammasome. What are inflammasomes, and what role do they play in inflammation?
Okay, so Inflammasomes are a huge protein complex in the cell. And they're formed in response to activation of another pattern recognition receptor. This family of pattern recognition receptors lives in the cytosol of the cell. And they're kind of interesting because they respond obviously to pathogens that get into the cytosol or bits of pathogens that get into the cytosol. And they trigger a response which is quite different to the toll-like receptors. So toll-like receptors drive a transcriptional response. And that causes an increase in gene transcription of a whole bunch of pro-inflammatory proteins. The inflammasome, in contrast, it has a much more limited function. So it does two things. It chops the ends off some inactive cytokines, which are pro-inflammatory proteins. So that's pro-IL-1 beta and pro-IL-18. And these then become very important inflammatory proteins that drive inflammation, but also drive adaptive immune responses. But they do a second thing, which is slightly cataclysmic for the cell because they kill it. Okay. So the inflammasome cleaves a protein called gastome, and that puts pores into cells. This then triggers a second pore formation protein called a NINJA-1, and the cell lyses. And that's a super important part of the inflammatory process because it releases a whole bunch of intracellular contents to the wrong place. Okay. So that helps to drive further inflammation. It also, I think, helps to drive an adaptive immune response because it's spattering out cell contents all over the place and they shouldn't be there. So that is a second arm then to an inflammatory response. How important they are as primary pattern recognition receptors, so the inflammasome-forming pattern recognition receptors, are they primary infection receptor? Are they primarily a sensor of disrupted homeostasis, I think, is an interesting concept, and it's something that a lot of us are interested in at the moment. But they're there. Some of them are very highly conserved, some of them less so. And they play an important arm. The pro-inflammatory cell death is, this lytic response is probably the most interesting things that they do that's quite different. There's no transcription downstream of inflammasome, so it really is lytic cell death and inflammatory protein cleavage.
And I imagine, based on what you just told me, that these inflammasomes would have roles to play not just in infections and detecting and helping destroy cells that have been infected by bacteria or some other creature, but also other types of cells that you might want to kill off, say like a cancer cell or some other broken cell.
Yeah, they do a whole bunch of things actually. So they can drive neighboring cell death. That's quite an interesting part of the process, and there's some very elegant work showing that. They can also respond to things like beta amyloid. They can respond to lipids that are not normal, physiologically normal. They can respond to things that are not normal to disrupted homeostasis of the cell. And the interesting thing, this is one in particular, which is driven by a receptor called NLRP3. This one in particular seems to sense a whole range of cellular disruptions, for want of a better word. And once this is switched on, it's very hard to turn it off. So it sort of drives a chronic inflammation. And that's kind of interesting, right? It's sort of not acute. In other words, it's not sudden and short. It's long and sustained until the cell dies. So they're a really interesting family of proteins that we're beginning to try and, or we've been looking at for quite a while. And in fact, there are a bunch of drug trials going on against NLRP3 in particular. And the biology is really beginning to come out as we try and understand how important they are. And the importance in Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease certainly seems to be one way in which they're important. Importance in atherosclerosis and other metabolic diseases is another role in which they're important.
So, thinking again about an inflammatory response initiated by a bacterial infection, obviously turning on that response is very important. That involves these pattern recognition receptors that we talked about. But turning off the response is also very important. You want to contain that inflammation both in space and time so that you're not causing collateral damage to the body. what kinds of mechanisms are in place that turn off the inflammatory response? Is it just the absence of the antigens that were part of the detection process, or are there other mechanisms that help our immune system know like when to stop the inflammatory response?
Yeah, do you know what? That's so much less researched than switching it on. Okay, it's very interesting. So you will obviously removal of the pathogen is step number one. If it's not there, you don't see it, you don't trigger an innate immune response, and you don't trigger an adaptive immune response. So that's one way. But there are a whole bunch of sophisticated mechanisms that are also involved. So as well as producing pro-inflammatory mediators, you also produce anti-inflammatory mediators, and they help to switch off the activity of inflammatory pathways in the cell. And precisely how those balance each other out is a topic of emerging importance, because you know, we thought a lot, myself included, we think a lot about, okay, what we need to do is to stop the inflammation being switched on. Because in some ways, easier is not the right word, but in some way that's more obvious. You can look at the steps that are there, you can interfere with those steps. Can you stop something being switched on? But probably a more interesting approach therapeutically is, okay, let's think much more differently. Let's just try and increase the anti-inflammatory mediators. Let's try and mimic them. Let's try and trigger the receptors that those anti-inflammatory receptors trigger in order to switch off the inflammatory process. And that's a big work in progress. And it's now something that's being very, very well studied and enthusiastically studied. But historically, it's been much less well studied than the mechanisms that switch it on. So there are a whole bunch of different anti-inflammatory mediators that will turn inflammatory processes off, and it differs depending upon the pathogen, what's been seen, what's the initial trigger, the immune response, because immune responses can take different flavors, and each of those will be switched off in a different way. Within the cell, things like inflammasomes are very tightly regulated, and there are ways of switching them on and there are ways of switching them off.
So you know, a major topic that a lot of people care about at different levels, and that pretty much everyone knows about at some level, is the problem of chronic inflammation. So inflammation that is persisting beyond when it's useful. Two-part question here. So the sort of the top layer question I'm going to ask you is simply, what exactly is chronic inflammation as opposed to acute inflammation? But I think a more specific way to ask this in the context of, say, an infection is, you know, I can imagine two broad ways that the acute inflammation that's induced by an infection becomes chronic. Could be, maybe you can't fully clear out, say, an infection, and you've got this kind of chronic low-grade infection that you just can't quite get rid of for some reason, and therefore you've got a chronic immune response to it. But another way I could imagine something becoming, like inflammation becoming chronic, is that the immune response to the pathogen is switched on, it works, it clears it out, but then something goes wrong such that it doesn't get switched off and it stays on.
Yep, both of those are true.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
So depending upon the pathogen. So for example, certain bacteria can lie dormant or can cause chronic infection. So they can sit in a cell and they can sort of sleep for a bit and then they can come out. You know, TB does that. TB sits not only in a cell, it sits in this granuloma and it kind of hides there until it decides to come out and cause problems. There are a bunch of other bacteria that do sort of similar things, and HIV is an example of a virus that can, they call it latency. Okay, so that's a term where it's still there, it's not doing anything, but it's there and it can be reactivated. So pathogens can do that, but there's also the process where an inflammatory response is switched on, but for some reason then doesn't get switched off. And that becomes very damaging and underlies, you know, a number of diseases, chronic bowel, you know, inflammatory bowel disease, for example, a whole bunch of autoimmune conditions. And sometimes these conditions can sort of what are called wax and wane. People can have flares, okay, which is where it dies down for a bit, either in response to treatment or some kind of change in environmental factor. And then a patient can be somewhere and the environment will change or something will trigger a flare and then the patient is ill again. These kind of disorders, and they're multifactorial, okay, and there's hundreds of them. And the more we understand about genetics, the more we understand the genetic basis for some of these conditions. The biology is beginning to emerge, and every condition has a variety of different causes. Ultimately, though, the inflammation is not being switched off properly.
So I'm going to ask you another vague question. I know there's not one answer here, but I'll let you just sort of decide what a good anchor point is. A lot of people have chronic inflammation that may or may not have anything to do with an infection. It seems to be related to your lifestyle in different ways, things you're eating, things you're doing or not doing. So for people who have chronic, because my understanding is that in the developed world, I don't know the numbers, but probably a majority of adults have some level of chronic low-grade inflammation. Where are some of the major places that this comes from, if it's not all coming from infectious agents?
So we don't know whether or not it comes from infectious agents, right? So
I
the, you
see.
know, it's quite possible that somebody had an infection back in the day and it's long gone, right? So even in an acute system, remember, people who died from COVID didn't die from the virus. They died from the infection having been there, triggered an immune response, and the infection's long gone, but the immune response is carrying on. So it's hard to know with a lot of these diseases what the initial trigger is. I would expect a lot of it to be driven by an early infection event, but sometimes, and particularly as we age, for example, there's this concept of inflammaging. So as you get older, you produce more inflammatory mediators, you produce more inflammation. We don't really understand why that is, but that certainly seems to happen. So if you imagine your baseline level of inflammation is increasing, you can imagine a scenario then where something that normally has been kept in check suddenly actually can be triggered because you've suddenly got a whole bunch of inflammatory proteins there that's just gone over the threshold of normality, because we all really exist in a state of immune homeostasis. So we don't have no immune activity at all. We all have a bit of immune activity. But imagine the threshold is raised because you're carrying a bit more body inflammation on board, and that is then enough to just tip you over the edge and to trigger a chronic inflammatory response. So that, I think, is all part of the same syndrome. There's an infection event, there's an internal inflammatory event. It's associated a lot with aging, and this is, of course, why people who age are more predisposed to some of these chronic inflammatory diseases. We think the inflammaging part is probably playing an important role here.
When we let's just think about the average chronically inflamed person, whatever that means, is this, and there may not be an answer to this question, is this likely someone that had inflammation triggered by a discrete event like a previous infection that then persists for years and years? Or is this more likely some kind of intermittent insult that is, continually triggering inflammation at a low to medium level, over and over again?
I think both factors can occur, I think you're almost asking the Holy Grail question, right? Because if we knew the answer to that, then we'd be able to design an intervention strategy. And as we understand more and more about different diseases with a chronic etiology, some of these things are becoming clear, and that's helping us. Particularly, imagine there's a cohort of patients that gets a disease that's got a defined genetic basis. You may not be able to help the older person that's got it, but in that family, you may be able to say, okay, look, this is likely to be a trigger factor. You either avoid it or you design a vaccine against it, or you design some kind of novel therapeutic such that we can ameliorate the genetic thing that's actually leading to this trigger. So there is multifactorial. There's a whole bunch of these factors that are involved. And we are understanding more and more and more along these sort of lines.
I want to ask you about allergies. What are they, and are they in fact becoming more common over time?
So allergies are and usually an acute, depending upon what it is, an acute or a more long-term inflammatory response against things you find in the environment usually. And what happens is, so for example, a house dust mite allergy. I'll give you this example because I'm an asthmatic and I'm allergic to house dust mites. So house dust mites have a number of proteins. It's actually pretty gross because they're produced in house dust mite poo. It's really quite unpleasant. your body will see this protein from the house dust mite, and most people won't care. But for some reason, in people like me, my immune cells see this house dust mite poo protein, and it will trigger this immune response, which will be, in my case, wheezing, runny nose, all those kind of things. And it's a overactive immune response against something that some people just don't notice. And these allergy responses are a real problem because they underpin diseases like asthma, for example, allergic asthma. They can underpin various inflammatory bowel diseases. They can underpin a whole bunch of diseases. And they do seem to be increasingly common. But that's kind of interesting because there's a hypothesis, for example, that because we live in a much cleaner environment now than we did back in the day, that what's happened is that because we live in a cleaner environment, you're not exposed to as much dirt, and therefore you haven't kind of got your immune balance right against some of these factors. I don't
Basically,
know.
the idea is your immune system hasn't been trained to discriminate between all of the things it once was, and therefore it makes more mistakes.
And not to worry about some things because it doesn't really matter, right? I don't know whether that's true or not. I spent a lot of time playing in dirt as a child because my dad was a doctor and he wanted me to be immune to everything, I think. And I was a tomboy. I don't know. It's a really interesting question. Are these allergies increasing? Are there just lots more people on the planet, which means that we're responding in a different way? Are we encountering a higher dose of toxins? For example, lots of people are allergic to diesel fumes, for example, and we know that's a problem, right?
Another hypothesis here that I think is interesting, it's really just sort of a sister hypothesis. It's not mutually exclusive, I guess. So if the hygiene hypothesis is, okay, we live in environments that are too sterile and clean, we're not getting enough exposure to dirt and pathogens to properly train our immune systems. Another idea that's out there is that the food environment and the general environment we live in is actually, stripping things in our gut, say, and that's allowing too many things to get into the body cavity that normally would be kept out. So it's actually sort of an overexposure thing that then triggers these allergic responses. Is there any evidence or thinking around that that's relevant?
I mean, I think that's feasible. I think, to be frank, I think all bets are off because we have a number of hypotheses as to what's causing and what's triggering allergies. Would that we knew, because if we did, we could intervene. And I think that's intrinsically a problem. It's very clear allergies are a serious problem and kills people, right? I remember having this conversation with somebody a long time ago on the radio, and we were talking about a paper we'd published about the cat allergy protein, because some people are horribly allergic to animals. Again, cats produce a protein that, in fact, it activates one of the pattern recognition receptors, and that's one of the mechanisms by which it causes an inflammatory response. And I remember a radio presenter saying to me, "Oh, what's the point of you doing this research? It seems to me completely pointless." And I'm going, "Really? There are people who die from allergies out there, and if we can stop people dying from severe allergies, then that's got to be a good thing." But it's really difficult to understand precisely where allergies come from and to understand all the hypotheses that are related to this. I mean, I think it's clear there's a genetic background that can predispose you to developing these kind of diseases, environmental backgrounds. There's a whole host of factors which are probably changing as the planet changes, as climate change comes along, as one's environment comes along, perhaps, one's responses to these things change. For example, in a damp environment, so I'm much sicker than I am in a dry environment with respect to my allergies. And I think there's so many multifactorial things involved. It's hard to actually pin this down. It's a great question, but not one that's easy to answer, I think.
Using food allergies as an example with which to think about the difference between allergens and pathogens. So let's consider someone with a food allergy, like peanut allergy or whatever. We talked about this pattern recognition system that's part of the innate immune response, whereby we have specialized receptors that are detecting certain components of, say, bacteria, these lipopolysaccharides and things like that. When it comes to the detection of allergens, what is being detected there? Are the toll-like receptors getting triggered because there's something similar to these bacterial components? Are they detecting other things that are completely distinct from what's on the bacteria? What does detection look like for allergens?
Yeah, so I mean, in the context that we were really interested, we actually saw that the allergen proteins were able to carry bacterial endotoxin from the environment. So if you imagine the environment in which we live in, we're also surrounded by bacteria and various allergen proteins. And the endotoxin is very sticky, so it sticks to all sorts of proteins. And it was clear from our results that what was happening was the allergen coupled to an endotoxin was increasing the sensitivity, because the amount of endotoxin in the environment is very low. But the allergen was somehow taking this environmental endotoxin, showing it to the toll-like receptor and producing a big response. So there's, again, a combination of pathogen factors that live in dirt, that live in the environment all the time. But this in association with either a pollen protein or an animal protein or something that's an allergen or a food allergen, all of these, this sort of combination of factors. And you can imagine in the gut, for example, we know the gut is full of bugs, full of bacteria. You can imagine a gut allergen coupling with a gut bacterial lipid, and this then triggering a pattern recognition response. So I think it's most likely that that's a key factor in triggering these kind of allergic responses.
Is it known, or is it possible that there might be, let's say it this way, could there be fundamental differences between allergens and pathogens such that in principle, we can come up with ways to interfere with allergen detection that don't mess with the immune system's ability to detect pathogens? Because I could imagine you could disrupt the system easily, mm-hmm. but a side effect is going to be basically immune suppression and susceptibility to infections.
So the answer to that is we think so, yes. In fact, I have a drug discovery program to do exactly this. And we're quite well on the way. So I think one of the things to bear in mind is that if you want to interfere in this process, which you can, you actually are not going to develop something that's going to take out every single pattern recognition receptor in the body. Okay, you'll probably take out a cohort of them. And what you're trying to do is to dial down that response. You're really unlikely that you'll produce a drug or an antibody that will take out the response of all these receptors to either to pathogens. Also, as you age, the adaptive immune system really takes over from the innate immune system. So it becomes less of a problem. In fact, the innate immune system seems to be less necessary as you age, because once you've seen a pathogen, you've triggered certainly the pattern recognition receptors rather than the innate immune system. Pattern recognition receptors have told the body this pathogen is there. When you've seen it once, you've then got a whole army of an adaptive immune response that will know this pathogen has come along, and it will send in the troops to take out the bug. So it's kind of an interesting concept, because we think it's probably pattern recognition receptors become less important in fighting receptors and more of a problem in responding to allergens or toxic proteins and so forth. So we think it'll be less of a problem. That's a very long answer to me saying that, yes, I think you can intervene, and it probably is not going to be that much of a problem.
I want to talk a little bit more about inflammation and aging. You mentioned inflammaging earlier. This is an area I know very little about, but I have some intuitions here. So thinking about infection and allergic response separately, starting with infection, I would imagine that as someone ages, as you said, naturally over your lifetime, you're building up this library of immune memories. So you've got this stored bank of adaptive immune responses that your immune system can create and carry a memory of. Those get built up over time, such that, as you develop, your adaptive immune system is getting stronger, basically. It has a larger repertoire to draw on. And therefore, the innate immune response becomes maybe a little bit less important over time. Simultaneously, the aging process inevitably is going to mean the breakdown of the natural biological mechanisms of the body. So when someone gets to be very old in age, is there Are they less susceptible to specifically to diseases that they've had an adaptive immune response before, but also more susceptible to new ones because their ability to actually form a new adaptive immune response or an innate immune response is compromised? How does the response to pathogens get stronger and or weaker as we age?
Yeah, there's a combination of factors that are involved. So one of the things that's clear, as you age, your ability to generate a response to a vaccine is not as good. And we think this is partly because your immune system gets tired, okay? Because you've driven the response to lots of pathogens over your life, and presumably there comes a capacity. And we know that the immune cells do get exhausted. It may sound slightly odd, but immune cell exhaustion, T cell exhaustion, is a well-known concept. Yes. And that means that you tend not to get as good an immune response. And in fact, depending upon the vaccine, some vaccines in particular, you can vaccinate people and they just don't produce as good an immune response. Now, partly it's a little bit hard to disassociate whether that is a primary failing of the immune system or if you can tweak. So when you have a vaccine, you usually have the antigen you're trying to make a vaccination response against. But you combine it with molecules called adjuvants, and they're kind of vaccine helpers, and they drive an inflammatory response that will then help to generate a really good vaccine response. So we don't really understand at the moment precisely which part of the vaccine response is failing, but it's really very clear that the older you get, certainly your response to some vaccines is not very good. And we also know that the older people are more susceptible to infections. And it does seem counterintuitive if you've got this whole library of immune responses banked in your body. But you can imagine a system whereby the immune response gets exhausted as you age because you're not replenishing everything as well as you would do if you're a younger person.
So, when you have increased susceptibility to infection in old age, is it known whether that's coming from... Is it a failure of the adaptive response to behave as it once did when you were younger, or is it a breakdown of the innate response that lets the pathogen in to begin with?
Or so both? I don't know for sure. I would guess it's both, right? Mm-hmm. And there's certainly clearer evidence for the adaptive immune response, I think, because the sort of slightly counterintuitive part is that it seems as you age, your innate immunity is sort of actually ramping up a bit. This is the inflammaging bit. Because your inflammatory status increases. So it would kind of suggest, and maybe that, I probably should know this, if anybody knows about adaptive immunity, they're probably screaming at the radio going, Clay, yeah, you should know this. So it may be that the ramping up of the inflammation is then trying to activate T cells and they're getting exhausted because they're not able to respond as well anymore. So you've got this sort of complex balance that's triggering into the gradual waning of your ability to respond to pathogens, for example. It's one of, in my opinion, it's one of the holy grails of trying to increase the quality of life in people as they age, is trying to get this immune balance better. What can we do to make that so that people have a healthy and well older life, and that they, you know, you have to die of something obviously eventually, but if we can make sure that everybody has a good quality of life, I think looking at this immune balance in old age is an important way to get to that. And to, you know, the aches and pains and the injuries and so forth, which are, you know, if you've got a high inflammation innate immune balance that's causing you to sort of have a general inflammatory response all the time, it's going to predispose you to damage basically and less efficient immunity.
I'm intrigued by what you said about the immune response or certain immune cells getting tired after more and more exposures to pathogens. Can you unpack that a little bit more? And I guess to add a secondary question to that, like in principle, is there a maximum number of lifetime infections that the immune system can potentially deal with? Is there a capacity?
Yeah, I mean, this is way off my area of expertise. But one of the things T cells have to do is they have to expand. All right, so a pathogen comes along, especially if it's seen before, you know, your memory cell is sitting there. There's not many memory cells sitting around. It's not like we've got a whole army of them. There's a memory cell that's sitting there, and the pathogen comes along, and it has to go and explode and produce lots and lots and lots of T cells. And there's a context where this doesn't happen as efficiently anymore, and it's called T cell exhaustion. And you see it with prolonged immune stimulation. Okay, so and
When you
you
say
the
prolonged, do you mean extra long infections, or do you mean
yeah prolonged
many
pathogen.
individual infections?
I mean, repeat infections is a different situation to a prolonged infection. So if a pathogen is present for a long time, you can see a drop off in the T cells. They're just not capable of reproducing to that high degree. With repeat challenges, certainly the innate immune system can desensitize. Okay, that's known, but it tends not to be a long insensitivity. It tends to be relatively short.
I see.
The adaptive immune system and repeat challenges, presumably something similar can happen, but this is a question for somebody who's an expert in adaptive immunity, which is definitely not me.
Got it. Well, we've already covered a lot about innate and even some adaptive immunity. Is there anything that you want to reiterate about innate immunity that we've talked about, or anything that you think is worth talking about that's important that we didn't cover yet?
I think probably one of the last things that would be worth having a think about is the concept of the intersection of metabolism with inflammation. And that brings me a little bit to our most recent published work, which was thinking about fasting. So this was a surprise to me because I used to work on prostaglandins. In fact, we talked about these earlier. We had this result saying, okay, so one of the things we know is that the inflammasome, which we were also talking about earlier, is a protein complex that's really important actually for driving chronic inflammation, but we don't fully understand how that complex in the context of NLRP3 is activated. And so we looked at lipids, and we looked at a whole range of lipid metabolites, and we thought, well, maybe prostaglandins are activating the inflammasome. That would be cool because that would be a great way in which an inflammatory pathway could be sustained. And I know our hypothesis was wrong, which is true. Most of my hypotheses are wrong, actually. I have a lot of fun trying to get to the answers, but actually, the explanations I get in the end are usually more interesting than my initial hypothesis, frankly. So this was another one of those hypotheses that was wrong. But what we could see when we looked at what was happening in the macrophage was that there was an increase in a lipid called arachidonic acid. And this is a very interesting lipid that's upstream in the metabolic pathway of prostaglandins. And, well, I thought it would be a pro-inflammatory lipid, but it didn't, it wasn't actually. It was able to switch off the inflammasome and decrease inflammation. And we thought this is really interesting.
Yeah, so before you go on, I've had some recent discussions that mention arachidonic acid in different contexts, thinking about dietary lipids. So when I hear arachidonic acid, I think, okay, this is an omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acid. It is a precursor ultimately to pro-inflammatory things like prostaglandins. So you naturally think more omega-6, more arachidonic acid, more arachidonic acid, more inflammation. But it sounds like this is going in a different direction.
I think that's kind of interesting, right? But there's a tendency to think in kind of linear pathways, right? It's more, 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 more. But one of the things we do know is that you can get substrate inhibition, okay? And that's a well-worked field in enzyme kinetics and so forth. And th this was really what we were trying to think about because we thought this is weird. I expected more arachidonic acid would mean more prostaglandins, but it doesn't seem to necessarily work like that. It will do under some circumstances, but for example, if you use an NSAID, we talked about NSAIDs earlier too, you get an increase in your arachidonic acid substrate, and actually this is kind of sitting there, not able to be channeled down the prostaglandin pathway. And so what we were finding was that this is then feeding back to inhibit the inflammasome to have other anti-inflammatory effects. So you have a sort of different pathway being switched on because you've disabled the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory pathway. And I think this is what can happen if you increase the amount of substrate in the cell. Yes, you'll get it processed through the traditional non-steroidal, sorry, through the traditional prostaglandin pathway, but you can have it affecting other pathways too. And the reason why this became interesting was coincidentally, actually, when we were doing this work, I was talking to some of my colleagues at the NIH and also in Switzerland. And they were saying, oh, it's really interesting. We've got this metabolic data from our plasma samples of people who've been on different fasting regimes. And so, as I'm sure everybody knows, fasting is good for you, and trying to understand why is actually a very interesting question. And so what they were seeing was they did lipidomics in the plasma, and what they found was that the one lipid that really went up in a big way was arachidonic acid, which they said, well, this doesn't make any sense because the arachidonic was going up. but they're inflammatory markers, and particularly interleukin-1 beta, which is processed by an inflammasome, was dropping. How can that happen? And I said, well, we might have the answer to that because we've been looking in cells. And we think the arachidonic acid can directly switch off the inflammasome activity. So I think this is a sort of convoluted way of saying there's really interesting pathways where metabolic regulation of inflammation becomes super important. And certain lipids, like arachidonic acid, can switch off the inflammasome. But there are other lipids, which are lipids that are produced if you eat what's called a Western diet. So if you eat too much processed food and you eat lots of fat, you can produce a range of toxic lipids, and they activate the inflammasome. So there's a sort of very complicated regulation.
Can you give us a little bit more detail there? Because I'm interested in that question. So the Western diet, one of the things it's characterized by is high level of fats, but the fats it tends to have a lot of, and this is where I get confused, are the omega-6 fatty acids, which arachidonic acid is downstream of. So do we know anything more specifically about which fats there?
Yeah, so there's a whole cohort of different fats, and they do different things, right? So the mechanisms by which they interfere with inflammasome activation is largely a transcriptional regulation. So they'll do things like change the epigenetics. So that's a way in which you can alter gene transcription. But there are also different individual lipids that can also activate the inflammasome as well. So there's, and I can't remember each of the individual ones because there is a whole family of lipids that directly activate the inflammasome that cause changes in the gene transcription of these proteins. And then also feedback into negatively regulate. So it's a complicated situation, and trying to understand how all these factors interrelate. And people who are fasting are often not the same as people who are, or the, not the same as people who are eating a high fat diet. Mm-hmm. You know, these kind of balances I think are important and not very well understood. But there are certain key fats here that are having an effect, and we know that this protein NLRP3 is very much regulated by a range of fats. And over time, I think this is going to become very interesting, trying to understand how this all fits together, because there's no doubt about it, it is complicated. Mm-hmm. But I would argue that metabolism is extremely complicated. Constantly fluxing metabolites are going up and down and all the time. And it actually trying to work out what this all means, I think, is something that will become apparent over time.
I see. So lots of unanswered questions here. So given that, one general way to parse a lot of that might be that there's many different fatty acids out there. There's many different fats that we consume, and there's many different pro and anti-inflammatory pathways in the body. So one answer is just it's very complicated. But to put a little bit more detail there, the exact balance of fatty acids you have is going to have a different effect on inflammation in the body. And my guess is it's probably not always going to be so simple as these fats mean more inflammation, these fats mean less. It probably depends on the exact dose and balance of each one.
Yeah, and your individual genetics. Mm-hmm. Okay. And how much you exercise, because for example, we know that if you look at your cholesterol, and there's different types of cholesterol, if you look at your cholesterol levels and various associated HDLs and LDLs, they can change even with exercise, right? So your dietary habits, your genetics, your exercise, a whole host of factors, which probably miserably mean we have to eat a lot less and do a lot more exercise, although I quite like exercise, so that's fine. But all these factors feed into regulating precisely how your inflammatory status is going to be. And if we do certain behaviors, or we try and shift our balance with certain feeding behaviors or exercise behaviors, we can shift that balance. And fasting is actually one example of this. And it was fascinating and surprising to me that we actually saw a direct correlation between a lipid and inflammation and anti-inflammatory effects. Mm-hmm. That we could explain by this sort of mechanism.
And when you say fasting here, what exactly was the fasting protocol that you guys used?
So the one that's in the paper was it was a short fast. So you were fed a meal. You had one was 8 hours and one was 16 hours, I think. And then you ate again. And
and is this a rodent or human
no,
study?
this was human. This was
Oh, this is
humans.
humans. Okay.
This is humans. Yeah, this is humans. And so that is a question I've been asked by more people from the media than anything else. How long do I have to fast to get this beneficial effect? And I go, I don't know yet. That's what we need to wait and see. And I think it's becoming more and more apparent that as the fasting regimes come out, and there's so much evidence in favor of fasting, but you have to do this in consultation with a doctor, because for some patient groups it's a disaster. You have to be very careful about considering fasting, for example, if you're a diabetic, because that's you understand what I'm saying. It's very
Yeah, there's
individual.
going to be different cohorts of people with different medical histories, but in general, for a relatively healthy person, is the finding generally that things like intermittent fasting are associated with less inflammation?
Yeah, that certainly seems to be the way. And what is interesting now is that we're beginning to understand some of the mechanisms behind that.
Interesting. Well, this is fascinating stuff. We've covered quite a lot of ground. Claire Bryant, thank you for your time. If there's anything else you want to leave people with, any final thoughts, go ahead and do that now.
I think be happy and be healthy.
Maybe eat less, probably.
Probably true, though it pains me to say it.
All right, Professor Bryant, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Nick.
Hey everyone, I want to take a minute to tell you about a really cool health monitoring device I've been using for several weeks. It's called Lumen, and it's a handheld, pocket-sized device with a sleek design. It measures CO2 levels in your breath, which allows their technology to determine the extent to which your body is burning fats versus carbohydrates. Lumen helps improve your metabolic flexibility, your body's efficiency in shifting between using fats and carbs. It improves your ability to burn fat, which decreases your hunger levels and makes your body less dependent on snacking, and it can increase your energy levels by helping you develop a high-functioning metabolism. I use this device in the morning, before bed, and after meals and workouts to track my metabolism. With just a couple weeks of use, I learned a lot about which foods were causing my body to burn mostly fat, mostly carbs, or both, as well as how long I need to fast each day to promote fat burning. Lumen is great for anyone looking to optimize their health for either weight loss or athletic performance. The easy-to-use app allows you to track your results together with what you're eating and how you're exercising, and it syncs with other devices like the Apple Watch. Click the link in the episode description to learn more and use the code MIND, MIND, in all capital letters to get $50 off your Lumen device today.